Hello and welcome to Held in Our Hearts Baby Loss Podcast. We are an Edinburgh-based charity providing baby loss counselling and support for bereaved families. We are committed to ensuring that no family has to face their journey of loss alone, and we wanted to create this podcast to reach out and share stories, encouraging greater connection and understanding. Join us on our journey as we speak to a wide variety of guest speakers who have been personally affected by baby loss or who have been moved by it. Hello, my name is Angie and welcome to episode 6 of our podcast. Today I had the opportunity to speak with Gemma Brady and Heather Taylor. Heather is the principal befriender at Held in Our Hearts and is a bereaved mother herself, having lost her precious daughter Ailey. Heather joined the charity 2 years ago, previously volunteering as a befriender. Before joining the charity sector, Heather had her career as a mortgage advisor and just recently finished a degree in psychology. Gemma is a befriender and volunteer coordinator with us and is also a bereaved mum to beautiful Tilly. Gemma previously worked in retail and joined us just over a year ago. We had a really meaningful conversation discussing the complexities around a subsequent pregnancy after loss and the complex emotions that this can bring up for families. Together we discussed the challenges of another pregnancy and coping strategies for managing relationships, others' expectations and practical tips for coping with anxiety, which I hope that you will find useful. We chatted about how a new pregnancy can affect your grief and how difficult it can be. Together we discussed about sharing news of your next pregnancy and how to manage inevitable questions around if this is your first baby. Then we talked more about ways of managing the build-up to baby's arrival and then coping with the complex and often conflicting emotions once baby is here. As always, if you or anyone you know has been affected by bereavement, please reach out to us at heldinourhearts.org.uk or email us at info@heldinourhearts.org.uk. And now let me introduce the wonderful Heather and Gemma.
Welcome to our 6th podcast. I'm delighted to have here today Heather and Gemma. Thank you so much, ladies, for joining me today on this beautiful sunny afternoon in Edinburgh. Delighted that you can be here.
Thank you.
So first off then, if I come to you, Gemma, could you share a little bit about yourself and how you became involved in the charity?
So I'm Gemma. I am, I'll start off with that I'm Evie and Tilly's mummy. So 7 years ago, I had my firstborn daughter Tilly, and Tilly was diagnosed with a diaphragmatic hernia at 20 weeks, at my 20 week scan, and we knew we were going to have a little bit of a fight in our hands when she arrived. And sadly, when Tilly was a month old, she after quite a few operations and things, she caught an infection and died, and we subsequently went on quite quickly to fall pregnant with her sister Evie, and Evie's now 5 and a half, and subsequently also nearly 37 weeks pregnant with another baby, so fingers crossed. I met the charity Held in Our Hearts when maybe about 6 months after Tilly passed away, and I had a couple of befriending sessions with Nicola. I just wanted to know that I was normal, and that my feelings and thoughts after Tilly had died were normal, and that's what my husband and I needed at the time. So we had a few sessions and kept in contact with the charity on and off over the years, and I started to work for the charity maybe about 15 months ago. I'm here and I'm a befriender for Held in Our Hearts as well. So that's
brilliant. Thank you so much for sharing about your journey and your daughters Evie and Tilly, and we're grateful to you that you can be here 37 and a bit weeks pregnant. Really grateful that you could join us today. Thank you. So over to you, Heather, if you could share a little bit about your journey to Held in Our Hearts.
Hi, so I first got involved with the charity
25 years ago when my first daughter Ailey was stillborn at 32 weeks. And back then it was support groups, that was all that was available. And I went to the support group and got a huge amount of support from them. Like Gemma, I went on very quickly to have another baby, and through that pregnancy I went to the pregnancy support group, which I don't think I could have got through the pregnancy without. It was a really big support to me. So when it would have been Ailey's 21st birthday, I decided I was going to have a Kaylee and raise some money for the charity just to give them something back. And when I went onto the website to find out where to pay the money, it seemed that they were looking for befrienders, and it just it seemed perfect. And I've been working for the charity ever since.
Fabulous, thank you. And thank you for sharing about Ailey as well. I remember the Kaylee because I remember meeting you and you coming in to share about the event for your daughter, which was a really special event. So today we're here to talk about something that we feel that is a really important topic, and something that we do a lot of support with the families. And we know that for families that we support, that the thought of entering another pregnancy can bring hugely mixed emotions. For some families, they absolutely know that they want to, but for others it can be a guilt-ridden decision, feeling that they might somehow be replacing their baby. So for both of you, it would be really grateful if you could share about how you went about making the decision to try for another baby after Ailey and Tilly, and when did you know that you were ready?
Oh, I think that's a hard one. It's kind of, I don't think there's ever feels like there will be a right time. For us, I know that my husband and I had decided, we actually used to talk to Tilly about it, and it was one of our last conversations with her, actually. Not that she was chatting back because she was a baby, but we talked to her about that we would continue to grow our family, as that has the decision that we had wanted to make. We decided to have a family in the moment we'd fallen pregnant with Tilly and saw that blue line, and we had that hope and the future planned for ahead, that we would continue to grow our family. We'd already decided we wanted to have more than one at that point. And we told Tilly, you know, even after she died, when we used to talk to her, that we would give her brothers and sisters if we could. It's always if you could, isn't it? And then when there's many times where you think, is this the right decision? We're not replacing you. You very much feel like you want to vocalise that to everybody around you, because for everybody else around you that hasn't suffered a loss, they're desperate for you to be happy again, and they're desperate for you to feel that love again and the happiness, because they want to make it better too. The first thing you always tell people is, it's not to replace this baby, it's not anything about replacement, it's that we decided that we would start a family. I mean, there's push and pull, the amount of times that we said, yes, we will, no, we won't, yes, we will, no, we won't. But also the sheer desperation, I know, you know, having Tilly be my firstborn meant I had empty arms. There was nobody at home to cuddle and to love and to give that to. So we decided that we would keep trying, and, you know, we were very lucky that we fell pregnant within like 4 months. But the 3 months that we didn't fall pregnant, each month hits you like a ton of bricks. Each time you don't fall pregnant, it's hard. So I know, especially talking to families, Heather, that's, we talk a lot about that, don't we? It is that real push and pull, because the last thing you want to do is, you're not trying to leave your child behind, you're not leaving your baby behind, you're trying to move to the next chapter, bringing everything with you, which is kind of a little bit. Do you feel like that, Heather?
Yeah, exactly as you said, Gemma. For us, we were the same. We decided we wanted a family, and I think it's almost, for me, it was almost like a primal instinct. I wanted a child to hold and to love and to take care of and watch grow up. So for me, it was, I would say it was quite an easy decision. I'm not saying it was an easy
it was easy then to go on to have the pregnancy, but the decision for me was easy. But I know from speaking to families, and that's not the case with everyone, and people, you know, some people do really get into quite a state about it. I think it's probably one of the questions that we're asked most often is, when is the right time? And there is no right or wrong, and it's whatever is right for you. However, I do think you have to be physically and emotionally ready to go through that pregnancy, because it is an anxious time when you're pregnant again following a loss. And just like Gemma said, you know, people maybe assume that you are trying to replace the baby you've lost. And I was always very conscious of saying that the baby that I was carrying was then Ailey's little brother or little sister. You know, I wanted to make sure everyone knew this wasn't a replacement. This was, you know, the next child, another child. So, yeah, it's a very difficult decision, and I know a lot of families struggle with it.
Absolutely. Thank you both for that. I think it kind of leads me on to the next point that I was going to raise with you both. I think it's that everyone around you, you know, kind of when you go and you make that decision to go on and become pregnant, hopefully, how others react to that, and, you know, that kind of almost an overcompensation, wanting you to be happy again and to be able to have another baby, and sometimes difficult. And I know that we hear from families about how difficult they sometimes find that when they're sharing, and how others react to the news that they're pregnant again. Heather, is this something that you hear from families quite a lot about, how they find it quite difficult to break that news and broach that subject and worry about how people will respond?
Yes, definitely. And in fact, a lot of families choose not to tell anyone for quite a long time. Definitely till the 12-week scan, but quite often even till 20 weeks onwards, because they're a bit scared to tell people because they're a bit scared of what that reaction's going to be. And, you know, I have heard so many different reactions. I've heard people that have been absolutely, you know, over the top, gushing, "Oh, this is the best news ever, congratulations," and planning baby showers and gender reveal parties and all this kind of thing, which is just like too overwhelming for a family who's had a loss. Or you get the people that just say, "Oh," and then you're left thinking, "Oh, are they judging me? Do they think I'm doing the wrong thing?" Or people that just don't say anything, and they're clearly pregnant, and everyone's just ignoring the situation because they don't know what to say. So, yeah, I think a lot of people choose not to tell anyone for a while, just because they're a bit scared of what kind of reactions they're going to get.
It's such a difficult thing, isn't it, to be, because you want to be sensitive and handle it well if someone breaks that news to you. But I think people sometimes don't know what to say, which maybe explains why you get that extreme range of reactions. I mean, for people listening that maybe might be in that position in the future, what would you, between you, kind of recommend, you know, how to respond when someone says, "I'm pregnant"? You know, what would be a kind of supportive response?
For me as well, I don't know if it's about just keeping calm about the situation, because loud and excited is not really how you feel. Nervous and anxiety ridden and petrified is kind of how you feel. And we want to feel excited. You want to move on to that next step, but you want that person to kind of understand. It's, you know, it's really difficult if you've not had a loss before. You can offer words of wisdom and love and support, but unless you've walked a mile in someone's shoes who has left a hospital without their baby, or has heard there's no heartbeat, then that anxiety will never go away. So that person sometimes just saying, "Oh, you know, I'm really happy for you. How are you feeling about it?" Maybe pushing it back on to that person. Is that how you would do, Heather?
Yeah, I think I would do the same. You know, could say something like, "I understand this could be an anxious time for you, and I'm here if you need to talk."
Mm-hmm. I think it's that acknowledgement, isn't it? And that empathy that you, like you say, you can't have unless you've been there and walked in their shoes, but that understanding. And, you know, that's why we're doing podcasts like this to help people understand, for those that aren't bereaved, you know, what this journey looks like and how best to support kind of family or friends or even colleagues that are in this position. So for families moving forward when they do become pregnant, one of the things that I know that we do see through counselling and potentially with befriending is that their grief can sometimes become stalled, that it's almost as if it's not possible to, you know, kind of physically or biologically to grieve their baby and then grow a new baby as well. Is that something that you have found, maybe yourself, Gemma, or kind of Heather, through the families that you've supported, that your grief changes and it becomes a different, almost like it's put on hold?
Yes, I think with my pregnancy after Tilly, I did have to put my grief on hold a little bit because I couldn't manage the two situations together. It was complicated and it was complex, and only by listening to other people talking about it or reading or 6 years ago podcasts weren't as they are now, but I used to do a lot of reading about it and listening to other people in the same situation, that, you know, I did have to park part of my grief with Tilly to be able to manage that pregnancy. Do you feel like that, Heather?
Yeah, I think so. Like for myself, I was pregnant really quickly after losing Ailey, and I think the only way to get through that was to kind of say, right, I'm putting this to the side just for now, and I'm going to concentrate on, you know, growing this baby and sort of dealing with your anxiety, because I think then it's rather than the grief side of things, it's anxiety that kicks in, and 9 months is a long time to get through. So, you know, you've got to do whatever you can to get yourself through those 9 months.
Yep. And I always remember thinking as soon as she was born, as soon as her sister was born, I then went back and I used to like writing. I couldn't verbalise what I wanted to say about Tilly or how I felt. And also I didn't really know who I wanted to verbalise it to. You know, sometimes it was my husband. Friends and family is a little bit more difficult because there's happiness for a new baby, but I need to pick up where I've left off. And I used to write about it a lot because it was just a way that I found easier. So there's different ways to kind of to think about it and talk about it and verbalise it in a way that I didn't want to. I wanted to write. And I'm no writer. It's not necessarily a beautifully worded book, but it makes sense to me. It's something that I actually do like going back to have a little read as well.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a really important point that you've raised, Gemma. I think, you know, there's no right or wrong way to kind of process or to grieve. And I think, you know, it's helpful to hear different ways. You know, for some people, journaling might be one way to help process. And like you say, maybe not able to verbalize or feel kind of confident to kind of share or even express how they feel, but writing is just a completely different way to kind of bring that expression out. Do you see that, Heather, with your families, different kind of ways that, uh-huh. that families might process their grief?
Yes, definitely writing. As you said, a lot of people I've said to them, what about writing your story? Because someone said it to me when Ailey was about 10 weeks old, 10 weeks after, you know, she had died. Someone said, why don't you write it? And I did it, and I found it really cathartic. So I've said it to lots of families, and lots of them have said, yeah, it's a great way to do it. But there, you know, I've also heard of people who have climbed up a hill and screamed at the top of a hill because they have so much anger and they have to get it out somewhere. And you know, they can't do it in their house. They can't do it when there's people around. But climbing up a hill and screaming at the top, and they've come back down again and said, you know, that I feel so much better. So yeah, there's lots and lots of different ways, and mm-hmm. I suppose it's finding what works for you.
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's such a personal thing, isn't it? And I think it's, you know, like it's a good example of the two, you know, very, very extreme opposites, but actually things that can help and kind of guide as you move forward. So I'm hearing from what you were saying, Gemma, you know, I think it's something that's important, you know, as we're talking about this, is that, you know, I guess if you think about pregnancy and you think it should be a time that's filled with kind of joy and excitement, but
we know, you know, kind of for bereaved parents, you know, the opposite is normally true, that it's a time that is very difficult and stressful and worrying and can be fraught with all sorts of kind of complex emotions. And I think it's something that, you know, we're sitting here now, April 2021, you know, over a year into the pandemic. And that's something that has put a huge amount of pressure on the parents that we support who've been pregnant through COVID, you know, not knowing the what's around the corner and the uncertainty of coronavirus and all the risks and associated vulnerability that brings to families, as well as not being able to access their normal support networks as well because of the multiple lockdowns. I'm just thinking for people that are listening here today, you know, if you could share a little bit more about different techniques that maybe you yourselves have found or things that you might recommend to families to help cope and reduce. We can't take away the anxiety, but you know, to help kind of reduce and coping strategies for managing anxiety through pregnancy.
Yeah, I think I'm going to let Heather talk about what we do in the charity and her and little bits because then that's taking. But for what I've been doing is that, it's such a horrible time. But also sometimes I think COVID has helped a little bit just now. For me, I know that being away from people actually helps because I don't have to discuss my pregnancy with them. So sometimes it's been a little bit of a plus. And then other times I forget that I am pregnant, and then people that do see me go, oh gosh, you're pregnant. And then I'm like, oh, and then I have to go into it. So it has its pluses. And for me, I think it would be, you know, I've always found, and Heather, it's probably one thing that we hear a lot from our families, scans are really stressful. And during this time, it's worse as well, because I know some families, you know, we're in a stage now in lockdown where they are letting partners in Scotland. So this is where we are. And in Edinburgh, partners can go in to all your scans. And that is so important, because to go to have the worst news that you possibly can in any scan. I've subsequently, after Tilly, I had two miscarriages. So going in thinking that everything was fine and finding out that there was no heartbeat, and I just couldn't have imagined going in without my partner or him sitting in the car park. So I know for me, scans are extremely triggering, and for a lot of our families, scans are extremely stressful. And by having kind of like the open communication with my partner, and he knows 24, 40 hours before that scan, I'm a crazy wife. And for me, it's always been, you know, weirdly enough, podcasts. So I need to listen to someone else talk because I need my mind and my needs taken off it. I need to, whether it be listening to a funny podcast or something else, it's just that it feels like someone else is talking and I'm listening and my brain can't work the way that I want it to overthink, because I don't want it to overthink. I don't want it to be thinking those things. And box breathing for me has been a huge plus. I know the journey to the hospital with me must be particularly unenjoyable, because it's, sometimes I feel like I'm going to have a heart attack. It's just so stressful. And your heart is racing, you can't concentrate on anything else. And to just spend that time focusing on your breathing, which is funny because that's what you do when you're in labour. So a lot of it, you realise that you're putting into play what you're about to do anyway. And wearing masks actually has probably been a bit of a bonus, because I'm that crazy lady in the corner in the maternity unit, about to get a scan, but I'm wearing a mask and I'm doing my box breathing. So I'm holding for four, laying out for four, holding for four. And, you know, I can focus on a table leg or a wall, something that's square, so that I can focus on that. I'm not focusing on anybody in the waiting room, and that just settles me. And I know that I can do it maybe like five or six times, and it will kind of bring my heart rate down, and I can feel it happening. I'm not into, I'm not very good with all these alternative therapies. I'm, you know, I'm probably the most craziest person when it comes to these things. So yeah, but that for me works, and that's probably the biggest link that I'll always send our families is box breathing, to kind of stop, collect, monitor your breathing, and it can just bring you back or just bring you down a level or two. It's not going to go away. But box breathing for me has been an absolute, I've never been able to do the diaphragmic breathing. I don't know if you have, Heather, or if you've sent that one to any families, but I always do the box breathing, if that makes sense.
I think it's something that's just so simple, isn't it? I think, you know, it's almost like something that you can have with you that, you know, when you are feeling that nervous kind of energy and tension, and you can feel, can't you, your heart rate going, you can feel your blood pressure rising when you're feeling that tension or anticipation, like you say, of kind of triggers, and something that you can, hold on to, that you don't need anything, you don't need to listen to anything, you can just use that. So I think that's a really good tip. And I'm glad, I'm grateful that you explained as well how to do it. Hopefully people listening can take that away. How about you, Heather? Do you have any top tips for ways to manage stress?
Like Gemma, the box breathing is the one that I send out to most pregnant ladies. I send that link. But also, I've heard from quite a few ladies, if they've tried the box breathing and it's not working, or they're sitting in the waiting room and then they find out there's a little bit of a delay, so they start to get a bit worried, or I can't do this box breathing anymore. Another really good one that they've done is looking for 5 things they can see, 4 things they can hear, 3 things they can touch, 2 they can smell, and 1 they can taste. And one lady also told me that, you know what, when she'd done that one a couple of times and there was quite a long delay before her appointment, she then went on to looking for 5 things that were red, 4 things that were orange, 3 that, you know, and went through all these different things. And she says it just worked because it took her mind off whatever else was going on. And no one needs to know you're doing it. You know, it's not like you're having to sit and go like, you know, point to your fingers. You can be sitting doing it and no one knows at all. And just for, not just for appointments, but just for general day-to-day, getting through those 9 months. You know, I've had ladies say to me that they've taken up crochet or knitting or something that you're not naturally good at, or something that you're not an expert at, because you have to think. And something that uses your hands and your brain, when you're doing that, you don't have time to worry because you're too busy concentrating on what you're doing. And also, I've had quite a few ladies that have told me they've chosen to learn the language when they've been pregnant. And I think at one point I had 3 ladies who were all learning sign language when they were pregnant. And, you know, again, it's just, there wasn't any particular reason for them to do it. It was something that was taking their mind off of their anxiety. And again, you're using your hands and you're using your brain. You don't have time to worry about anything else. And even if it's just giving you that little break for half an hour, sometimes that's enough just to then get you through. I know when I was pregnant, after losing Ailey, I started making these little Christmas cross stitch things. Now, I'm not a crafter at all, but they were small, so, you know, it wasn't this massive big task ahead. And I just would sit, if I was in the evening, if I was getting a little bit anxious, I would sit and I would make some of these. And, you know, 25 years on, I've got about 20 of them and they still go on my Christmas tree every year. So it's actually quite nice because it's also a way that I can remember that pregnancy.
So. Mm-hmm. Well, there's some absolutely brilliant ideas in there. Thank you so much. I love the idea of, you know, it's all things to find a way to calm your thoughts, isn't it? To just, you know, kind of almost detach and think, you know, kind of if it's your breathing or thinking about what you can smell, what you can see, just ways to kind of calm down your nervous system. So I think there's some really, really positive suggestions in there. And even learning sign language, you know, different things to keep people occupied and help, you know, kind of allay anxiety, even if it's just for a short time. Mm-hmm. So one of the questions I wanted to ask you about was thinking about going forward, so when you're pregnant again, about accessing antenatal support and kind of what that would look like, and also peer support, so other mums-to-be, and how you would manage or how you've coped with kind of inevitable questions innocently asked but sometimes very difficult to answer about, is this your first? You know, how have you responded to that, and what advice would you give to mums that are listening?
Oh, bless, that is, isn't it, Heather? It's one of the most commonly asked questions. When someone sees a bump, they just open their mouths and it says, no, is this your first? And it's really, you know, it's frustrating because sometimes I think I normalize baby loss, and that's never a part of my life that I wanted to do, but it is normal for me, and you know, that is my normal. And you know, when you are very raw and you're first in your grief, and you're, and this is your first baby after losing a baby, it's conflicting, because you never want to deny your baby's existence, and to deny their existence hurts more than actually them not being here. So you know, when the first couple of times it happens, it just knocks you for six, and you stand there for those extra few seconds not sure how to answer, because actually the lady in the till in Tesco or the person that's on the phone, they, you know, you're never going to necessarily see them again. So you kind of have to take that moment to decide, am I going to tell you or am I not? And there's times where I have told them, and you can see in their face and they're shocked, and sometimes they don't know what to say, and other times some people will just say, I'm so sorry, and you know, that's just so kind, and that's absolutely fine. But there's times where you'll tell people, yes, it's my first, and you know, and I've been there, poor telephone guy from the TV repairman said, you know, is this your first? And I said, yeah. And then 2 seconds later in tears, no, it's not my first, I can't. I just couldn't. And my husband, bless him, was like, oh, please don't tell that man. And the guy was brilliant. He was absolutely amazing. He was just like, I'm so sorry, tell me about your little girl. And some people are just so kind. But you're aware that, you know, that was a question. People ask questions without thinking. And so that's a really difficult one. And that's one that every parent comes up against. And it is really, it is a really hard one. If you had a dime for how many times you got asked that, isn't it, Hannah?
Yeah, no, I agree. I think it's a really difficult question, but I've heard from some parents a really good way to deal with it. And what it is a couple of ladies that I've met in the support group, they actually stood in front of a mirror and they practiced saying, you know, whatever it was they had chosen to say. So, you know, my first baby died. I'm pregnant again. And they said it sounds a bit silly, but it really works. And because I think it's that saying it out loud sometimes that takes your breath away when you hear yourself saying to someone else. So by doing this, they said it made them prepared. So if they're walking along the street and they see someone they've not seen for a while, or you know, that just that kind of situation where it's, oh, is this your first baby? Rather than it swiping them from under their feet, they were prepared and they knew what they were going to say. And I then in turn have told this tip to lots of other women, and they said, you know, they've tried it, and at first they feel a bit silly standing in front of the mirror and practicing, but now they've got it down to a T. They have their statement, it's already prepared, and they know exactly what to say. So when that moment comes up, they just, you know, they can easily say, actually my first baby died. And as Gemma said, you know, sometimes you get people who are just lovely and, you know, want to ask more questions. Other times people will just won't say any more. You know, they're not ready to hear any more, or you're never going to see them again. So they're, you know, they're not going to ask anything, and that's fine. But it's just having that little bit of being prepared, so you're not going to get swiped off your feet, because that's what happens sometimes. It comes out the blue. And it's like, you know, a punch in the stomach, and you think you've got this little fight going on in your head saying, what do I say? What do I say? Do I tell them? Do I not? So that's my top tip.
I think that's a really great piece of advice to share, because I think it's that question that, you know, is just, like I said, is so innocent, but, you know, it's people without thinking ask, and then obviously if they ask and they get a response like that, they might think twice to make that assumption. But I think it's, and also I think I hear what you're saying, Gemma, as well, about making that judgment call about, do you want to share, do you not, you know, and the difficulties around that. But it's kind of, you know, it's okay to just do what feels right for you in that moment. But it's lovely to hear that people in the main respond really well and kind of, you know, kind of with empathy, which is great. So moving forward then, to think a little bit more about kind of getting towards the birth, like we said before, you know, kind of being pregnant, you know, people around you, your family, your friends, your colleagues, you know, people get quite excited, you know, kind of, when's your due date? How long have you got? All those questions that come up. you know, but we know for bereaved parents that it can be a really, really difficult time, particularly coming close to the due date. And there's also a lot of expectations that people have and kind of start to ask you questions about, you know, have you prepared the nursery? You know, have you got all the baby items ready? Have you got the car seat to go? You know, are you going to have a baby shower? And that can be a really, really difficult time for families to negotiate and navigate through. I'm wondering, Gemma, if I could hear a little bit from you about kind of how you've managed that or managed people's expectations and maybe some of the things that you've chosen to do or things that you've chosen not to do.
Mm-hmm. I think for me, both pregnancies actually, after Tilly, it is isolating, you know, after you've suffered a loss, unless somebody has been through something similar, and that's why, you know, like having a befriender and that person to speak to, you can be open and honest without it coming across as raw. Because if I was 100% honest with my friends and family about how utterly out of control I was, they would be worried for my mental health. You know, it comes across like I'm a crazy lady, but, you know, we all know that it's that feeling out of control, but and you nothing is going to fall into place until you have that baby in your arms or you leave the hospital with that baby in the car seat, because our normal is not that. And it's really difficult because friends and family want to support you and they want to give you the words that are right, and to say, you know, I felt worried too. But your normal is to leave with your baby. My normal is not. And my normal is to have the worst news in the world. And that's where it can be isolating. So you do tend to not tell the truth and not talk about it. It's easier to move on to a different subject. But I think I found it very kind of, you have to, at a point, I would have to get to a point in my pregnancy where I had to take control and I would have to decide, right, well, that's it. Now it's time to maybe go and buy something. And once you kind of get past the 20-week scan with our children, you know, I would say to my husband, I'd kind of give him the green light. And he, you know, he always followed my lead. He was really good, really supportive with it, to say, right, let's go to the shop, you know, I'm a control freak, and after loss you can turn into a bit of a more of a control, you know, we're used to not being in control, and you know, when someone tells you that news, it can mean everything else. My ducks have to always be in a row and they have to be perfect, and so right now is the time where we can go and buy a baby item. So, you know, why don't you buy what you want and I'll buy what I want. You know, we both, like, he would buy a dress or I would buy whatever, and that was my nod to say, right, this is it, we're going to continue on with believing we're going to have a baby, because at a point you do have to stop and try and believe that yes, you are going to bring that baby home and that is going to be your normal, and this is, it's going to be different. It's, you know, being pregnant doesn't magically fix it, but at points you have to force yourself to believe that. How do you feel about that, Heather? I feel like that's what I felt was weird.
No, it's not weird at all. I think everyone is so different, and I think friends and family really have to take the lead from the lady who is pregnant and the dad. But yeah, definitely, you know, there's, I know families who have been, you know, 37 weeks and they don't have a hospital bag packed, and they haven't bought a single thing because they feel they're tempting fate, and or they can't do it. And, you know, I've had to sit with them and say, you know, there's a chance that there is a real chance that you're going to be bringing a baby home anytime soon. So, you know, is it time to get something, be a little bit prepared? And there's actually other families who go complete opposite. And, you know, I've known families who have just gone completely over the top, in fact, because they really want to believe they're bringing the baby home, but also they want, if on, you know, the off chance that the pregnancy does go wrong, they want to feel that they have given this baby as much love and attention and, you know, given it its place while the baby was here. So it is really difficult, but I think it's always, you know, let the pregnant family take the lead, and you know, you go with whatever they want.
Absolutely. I think I've been hearing that kind of through this conversation. I think it's, you know, for those listening to really kind of take their lead from the parents about what they feel comfortable with, because there's just so many different, you know, like you say, some families want to be really prepared, and some families, you know, that buying one baby grow, you know, at 20 weeks, 25 weeks, 30 weeks is a huge, huge step that, you know, some might manage to and some might find too difficult. So I think the other thing as well that I think about, you know, is the reality that you don't need that much, you know, and it's being sensible about not feeling that you have to bring in everything and do everything, and you know, and it's just what's right for you and your partner. So thinking about when baby arrives, all being well, we know that families will still, it's not like the anxiety disappears, you know, depending on their experience or kind of what stage their baby died, you know, it's normal to still feel very anxious. And there can be really difficult, complex emotions if they have had a baby that is of the same sex, that maybe looks similar to their bigger brother or bigger sister. How did you manage this, and how did you manage sharing about their older sibling to your baby? If I can come to you, Gemma, first.
I was petrified going for a 20-week scan and finding out, obviously 20-week scan's not for that, but you know, you can find out in Edinburgh if you're having a boy or a girl. And we had decided that, again, my controlling this needed to know what we were having, so that I could mentally prepare whether Tilly had a brother or sister. And, you know, and we found out very quickly in the scan that we were having another little girl. And that's confusing. We'd always spoken about, we did want to find out, again, from finding out that at 20 weeks with Tilly, that she may not survive once she was born. It was my sister had spoken to me about building a relationship with her while she was inside my tummy. So for me, it was quite common. I tried to build that relationship with the babies inside my tummy, although it was really complex and difficult, to think that if I know whether I'm having a little girl or a little boy, I'll know that. Then finding out you're having the same sex babies, and then it being really confusing, thinking, well, what if you look the same? If you look the same, that's it. I can't deal with that. And that is worrying. And many of our parents, that's such a complex one. And, you know, we talk about that a lot, is, you know, do I want to know? Don't I want to know? And if it's a different sex, is that harder? And that's, that's a question that we go through a lot with our families. And then when Evie was born, I remember thinking when she came out, will you look like her? And will I not love you that much? Because obviously I didn't have a child at home, and I didn't know. It was like I had one baby and she died, and then I went on to have another baby. And many, like a parent bringing home their second child, whether your child is living or not, I didn't know you could love two people as much as that. So when she was born and I looked at her and I spent time, I thought, God, you're not alike. There's not, you know, I'm aware now that when you look at siblings, they don't often look very alike either. And spending that mm-hmm. time with her by myself in the middle of the night in the hospital, you know, kind of all kind of fell into place that, no, you don't look alike. Yes, there's similarities, but it's at peace with me now that you're not your sister. Mm-hmm. and that had been such a huge fear, because I thought, how can I love you like I love your sister? She's not here, so she'll forever be innocent, she'll forever be that most well-behaved little girl. She's never naughty because she's not here, so she will always have that absolute innocence about her that, bless her, poor sisters are just never going to have. Like, always going to be the best behaved girl. That for me, it became easier. And with our families as well, you know, quite often it's just spending time, and that time once the baby is born, because we don't know what's going to happen until the baby arrives and how you're going to feel.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you for sharing. I love that idea, the idea that you feel almost like you couldn't have enough love for another. But I always think that
you know, when you have another, it's like your heart just grows and expands and you realize how much capacity you have to love. So yeah, that's lovely to hear. Heather, how about you after Ailey?
It's funny because with Ailey, you know, I really couldn't have cared less if she was a boy or a girl. I wasn't interested in finding out until that day, and I wanted a surprise. And then when I was pregnant again, it was one of the first things that, you know, I want to know if this is a girl or a boy. And partly it was to be prepared, you know, just like you said, but also I wanted her to have a name as soon as possible, because Ailey wasn't Ailey until she was born. If she was a little boy, she was going to be called Dylan. And I, you know, when I was pregnant again, I wanted that name as soon as I possibly could, so that, you know, she would be Hannah from, you know, when I found out she was a girl. And I think it's just all that sort of bonding, and, you know, for her to be an actual person and not just something that might or might not happen. You know, I wanted her to have that. You know, as Gemma said, when the baby's here, you realise that every child is different. I mean, they're probably, even with identical twins, you know, there's always going to be differences. And I always dealt with it by saying, I would actually say out loud, you know, this is Ailey's little sister. And I know nowadays you can get lovely little baby girls and things. I've seen some of the families of support have had, you know, their child and a little baby girls saying, you know, I'm the little brother, or I'm the little sister. And I just think that's lovely, because it's making that, you know, it's differentiating between the baby they've lost and the next baby. But that, you know, we're making light of some of the things there, but actually it is also really difficult when the baby is born. You have so many mixed emotions, and you're obviously ecstatic that your baby is here and safe and well, but you then have guilt that you're doing things with this baby that you never got to do with your baby that died. And, you know, for me, because Ailey was stillborn, I think also then having Hannah, it actually opened my eyes to exactly what I was missing out on with Ailey. So then it, you know, it's coming back to, you know, parking the grief and then picking it up again. And I think I did pick it up again then and say, right, okay, now I see what I'm actually missing. I have to deal with this.
I think that's something that we see a lot with families, don't we? After, you know, if they've gone on to have another baby, and it can, yeah, be an incredibly, particularly if it's the same sex as well, but lots and lots of complex emotions that come up with that.
Yeah, I went back to my writing at that point because I felt really, maybe a few weeks down the line, I felt really conflicted about that. You know, all the things that I hadn't done with Tilly, you know, that I did with my baby that was home, and I went back and wrote to her. That was my way of speaking to her, to saying, you know, we were denied this, and we were, you know, we didn't get to do this. And to me, that just put me at peace, you know, that I could write to her. And it wasn't that she was there, but she could, it sat right with me.
That's beautiful. That's a lovely, lovely thing to have been able to do. And, you know, again, going back to that idea of journaling, being able to put that somewhere, you know, maybe something that at the time you couldn't verbalise, but you were able to share with Tilly and kind of remember her at the same time as well.
Yeah. And I think it's also like, you know, when you have two babies who survive, you're torn, you're being pulled between the two. And it's no different when you've had a baby who died and then a baby who survives, you're pulled between the two. And, you know, I've heard quite a few ladies saying that they've realised what they have to do is make time for both. Mm-hmm. So they will, you know, go to the cemetery, or they'll go to a special place, or, you know, and have that as, like, for me, it would be like Ailey's time. And I would go to the cemetery and that would be just for Ailey. And then I would, you know, come back home and look after Hannah, and that would be Hannah's time. And I think that's a really good way deal with things is to make sure that you're giving time to both, just as you would if both babies had survived.
I think that's a real big part of our, you know, journey is to continue, you know, you're not pushing it down, you're bringing it with you, you know. And for me, it's always been a real part of me that Tilly is on my journey, you know, not front and forward, not everybody knows, not everybody can see it, but she's with me. And you're right, and you've given both your children that time. Maybe I've, once I get to the point where I have more than one at home, I'll understand that a lot more, but yeah.
That's lovely, ladies. I think that's a really nice point to end that discussion. I think that acknowledgement and understanding that, you know, kind of space and, you know, what you're left with, you know, is the love for the baby that's no longer here, but actually being able to give them time and space as well that you can dedicate to them in whatever way that might be, whether that's writing a letter or taking time somewhere that you remember being when you were pregnant with them or visiting your graveside. And that's a really, really kind of powerful and important point to end on. But before we finally end, I've got one final question. If you've listened to our podcast before, you'll know what's coming up. We ask all our guests to share something that you're grateful for, or it could be someone, maybe just today, or something that you're grateful for in the past and that you can share with us. So I'll come to you, Heather, first. And what or who are you grateful for?
Well, I am definitely grateful for all of my children. It goes without saying. But also, I am grateful that I have managed to get my wash and dried outside for about the past 5 days. And when you've got a family of six, you know, that's amazing. So I am over the moon for that.
Simple things, easily pleased. I love that, Heather.
I feel you.
And your wonderful children. And Gemma, what are you grateful for?
Mine's not as funny as that now. So I'm grateful for my team, my family, my husband, this team that we've created with us and our girls. You know, we've taken the worst and the best. You know, we've had the saddest times together as a family. Poor man only married me 7 years ago, and I've done nothing but cause him problems when it comes to having children. But he's, you know, we make a great partnership, and if it wasn't for him, then I wouldn't have managed to get through all this. So I feel like him and my girls we have the best time together and the worst time together. So I wouldn't have it any other way.
Oh, fabulous. Thank you so much. Well, all that's left for me to do is just to say a huge thank you to you both for sharing, you know, your own personal journeys as mums to Ailey and to Tilly, but also to thank you for your time today and to share about your experience and work with the charity. So thank you very much, and have a good rest of day. And thank you to everyone for listening.
Thank you.
Take care.
Thank you.
Thank you so much again to Gemma and Heather. I hope that you found that insightful in the strategies we discussed about managing your anxiety, sharing your news, and advice about preparing for baby's arrival were helpful. Also, I hope that hearing Gemma and Heather's own experiences of pregnancy after loss and their personal reflections on how they have managed their grief for their precious daughters Tilly and Ailey have given you some comfort. As always, please reach out or follow us at our website, heldinourhearts.org.uk, or email info@heldinourhearts.org.uk if you need support. You can also follow us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. Thank you so much for listening, and we hope that you'll join us next time.